Have you ever been in a conversation where you wondered if the person was ever going to get back to the main point of what you were talking about? Maybe you have a coworker or an in-law, and you can be talking about a subject, and he or she will start into a long story or a diatribe, and you just know it's going to be at least 5 minutes before you get back to what you were talking about in the first place. This type of talker was forever immortalized on the 60s television show Green Acres. How many of you are old enough to admit watching Green Acres? I found out this week there are still a lot of fans around 50 years later. You can still watch this. You can still stream it on Pluto TV. You can get Pluto TV for free. I think you have to watch half an hour of ads in order to watch a half hour program. One of the most memorable characters was Hank Kimball, the county agent who would visit Oliver Wendell Douglas to help him with his farming questions. And Oliver would ask Hank a question, and Hank would begin to answer. But soon he would take a tangent, and then another tangent from that tangent, and then a tangent from the tangent from the tangent. And ultimately, the conversation would never get back to the question that Oliver asked. Well, it seems to me that there is a little bit of Hank Kimball in the Apostle Paul. Take a look here at the passage before us in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and I hope you'll be able to see what I mean. Paul begins the body of this letter in verse 10. And the first topic that he addresses is the divisions in the Corinthian church, or as we called them last Sunday, the tears in the fabric of that local church. But in the middle of that paragraph extends through verse 17, in the middle of that paragraph, Paul hangs a left. And he talks about baptism for nearly four verses, the end of verse 13 through the beginning of verse 17. And then, in the middle of verse 17, Paul takes another tangent from that tangent. And he begins talking about his preaching of the gospel. Now, here's the thing about the ramblings of the Apostle Paul. They are not like Hank Kimball's. Often his tangents contain nuggets of gold. And verse 17 is just such a verse. Read verse 17 with me. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of no effect. Paul's tangent here in verse 17 turns from baptism to the gospel, and Paul makes an astounding statement about the gospel here. He says there's a way to preach the gospel that makes the cross of Christ of no effect. Did you know that? Did you know that the New Testament teaches such a thing? There is a way to proclaim the gospel that makes the cross of Christ empty. That's the literal translation of that last word in verse 17. Empty. By how we share the gospel, we can empty it. Empty it of what? Well, different versions answer that question differently. Many of you read the English Standard Version, the ESV. It translates, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. Here, our New King James translates, lest the cross of Christ should be made of no effect. Effects are results. We could translate, lest the cross of Christ should be made empty of results. Another modern reliable version translates, that would have made the cross of Christ lose its meaning, empty it of its meaning. I tend to think all of these are good translations. We can proclaim the gospel. A preacher can preach the gospel in a way that empties the cross of Christ of its power, of its results, of its meaning. As a preacher, I'm shocked by that verse. If you love Jesus Christ, if you cling to the cross, if you have a heart for the gospel, then you immediately react. Never. I would do anything to ensure that the cross of Christ was not emptied of its power, of its results, of its meaning. And this morning, that's just how we're going to spend our time, figuring out how to ensure that we do not proclaim the gospel in a way that will empty it of its power and its meaning. And our efforts will center around a little phrase there in verse 17. Wisdom of words. Paul says that if we proclaim the gospel in the wisdom of words, we will empty it of its power and its meaning. But what does Paul mean by wisdom? It's actually singular in the original language. It's wisdom of word or wisdom of speech. I mean, wisdom is normally a very positive thing for us as Christians, right? There's an entire section of the Old Testament labeled wisdom literature. The book of Proverbs continually lifts up wisdom, conveys wisdom. It also often speaks of wise words and the power of wise words. So how can the wisdom of word empty the gospel of its power and its meaning? I believe Paul gives us the answer to that question in verses 18 through 25. Let's read them together. 1 Corinthians 1, beginning in verse 18. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached, the gospel, to save those who believe. For Jews request a sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Now, as we trace down through that paragraph that we just read, we find several synonyms for the wisdom of word, the wisdom of speech. In other words, Paul doesn't use that phrase anymore in this paragraph. He doesn't talk about the wisdom of word anymore. He uses other phrases instead. In verse 19, he speaks of the wisdom of the wise, which God will destroy. In verse 20, it has to do with the scribe and the disputer of this age. At the end of verse 20, he speaks of it as the wisdom of this world. And then finally, in verse 22, we find that it is the wisdom that was prized by the Greeks. So now we're getting somewhere. Paul is not talking about biblical wisdom in verse 17. He's not talking about godly wisdom, but human wisdom. He's talking about the wisdom that was prized by the ancient Greek culture, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. The Greeks believed that they were capable, their philosophers were capable of arriving at life's the answers to life's big questions through their human intellect, through their rational abilities. We could say that the Greek philosophers believed that the human mind was the path to knowing God, the path to eternal truth. Now, most of us have heard of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, but there were literally dozens of other philosophers who had their followers in the Greco-Roman world. You know, today our country is split up by which team you are a fan of. You know, here in the upstate, it's Clemson, or there still are a few surviving Carolina fans, I believe. I grew up near Pittsburgh. I'm part of Steeler Nation. And in many churches around the country, we have people, they're Christians, yes, but they're also fans of certain teams. Well, in the Greco-Roman world, people weren't fans of sports teams. They were fans of certain philosophers. And that didn't stop when they became Christians. That's what Paul's saying here. They were Christians. They would have said that they followed Christ, yet they still believed that this philosopher or that philosopher, what that philosopher had to say, what he taught was true. And this commitment, this imbibing of Greek wisdom, Greek philosophy, also affected how they believed that communication should be done. That was a big part of Greek culture. Greeks were not just committed to philosophy. They also set great value by the ability to communicate, to argue, to persuade. It's called rhetoric. I work for a man who has a PhD in rhetoric. That's the ability to persuade. People still study it today. And back in that day, it was highly prized by even the Corinthian Christians who were part of that church. And here's the point. It affected the way that they believed that the gospel should be proclaimed. They believed that the rhetorical devices that were taught in those schools of philosophy, that was the best way to communicate the gospel. That was the best way to persuade people to come to Jesus Christ. There's a sense in which the gospel, the Christianity, the Christ crucified that Paul preached had been overlaid in the Corinthian church with this Greek philosophy and this rhetoric. And Paul believed that part of what he needed to do, part of what he needed to address in the Corinthian church was he needed to dislodge the place that this Greek wisdom, that this philosophy and rhetoric had in the hearts of those Corinthian Christians. I think he wanted to rip it away from them and to throw it on the trash heap of history. And that's what he's trying to do in verses 18 through 25. So first of all, Paul attempts here to dislodge the wisdom of word, the wisdom of speech, by connecting the humiliating word of the cross with the power of God. By connecting the humiliating word of the cross with the power of God. Notice verse 18. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Now, verse 18 literally begins, for the word of the cross. I think it's obvious that at the beginning of verse 18, Paul is contrasting the word of the cross and the wisdom of word. So he spoke of the wisdom of word in verse 17. Now he speaks of the word of the cross. So what does this contrast look like between the word of the cross and the wisdom of word? Well, the word of the cross, the message of the cross, the gospel, is foolishness to those who perish eternally. In other words, it's foolishness to those who would follow the wisdom of word, the wisdom of the Greeks and the philosophers. It doesn't look anything like that wisdom that was so prized by that Greek culture. To the world, to the Greeks, it looked like foolishness. And the word foolishness there in the original language is moria, from which we get our English word moron. To the world, the word of the cross is for morons. Now let's stop for a minute and really try to understand why. Why intelligent, educated people in Paul's day thought the gospel, thought the word of the cross, was only for morons. And it all centers on the cross as a means of capital punishment by the Roman Empire. There's almost no way for us, I realize we're in a post-Christian culture, but our culture is still highly sensitive to Christian symbols and Christian ideas. It's very difficult for us to grasp what the cross meant during the Roman Empire. But I'm going to try. The shame, the revulsion, the horror of the cross was communicated by the Roman philosopher Cicero. He said it was so unspeakably ugly that it was off limits in polite conversation. Let me quote what he said. The very word cross should be far removed not only from the person of a Roman citizen, but from his thoughts, his eyes, and his ears. Don't let me see a cross. Don't let me hear the word cross. This is not something for polite society. The best way I could say it today is that it was literally a four-letter word. Crux. That's the Latin word, the Roman word for cross. It had the same impact as a four-letter word would have uttered in your polite society. It was not to be done. It was not to be heard. And it wasn't just Roman citizens. It wasn't just the elite that had this view. There are remains of graffiti on a wall in Rome. They are a crude picture of a foolish-looking young man worshiping a crucified man with a donkey's head. And below it is a caption that reads, Alexamenos worships his God. Only a moron would worship a crucified donkey man. And it wasn't just the Greeks and the Romans who held this view. Many Jews had the same revulsion for the cross. And that was because Deuteronomy chapter 21 said that any person who was put to death and hung on a tree was cursed by God. And many Jews during this Roman era applied that verse to death by crucifixion. And so they would have believed that Jesus was cursed by God, for he hung on a tree. So get what I'm saying. For nearly any person alive in 55 AD, when Paul wrote this letter, the idea that the Son of God, that the Savior, that the Lord, that the King, that the person that I worship had been put to death on the cross, it's unthinkable. It makes no sense. It's like 2 plus 2 equals 5. Everybody knows that's not so. You have to be a moron to buy that line. You understand what I'm saying? Are you getting some of this? So that's how the Corinthian culture would have viewed the cross. But those who trust Jesus for salvation view the cross in a completely different way. For them, the cross is the power of God. To the world, it is foolishness, but to those of us who are saved, it is the... And you know, we don't expect Paul to say the power of God. We expect him to say it's the wisdom of God. To the lost, it's foolishness. Well, then to the saved, it must be wisdom. But that's not what he says. He surprises us. He says the gospel, the word of the cross, is the power of God. Paul picks up where Romans chapter 1 left off. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation. Only Christ crucified, only the word of the cross, only the gospel has the power to rescue us from hell, has the power to deliver us from the eternal penalty of sin, has the power to turn us from being enemies of God to being the children of God, has the power to change us into new creations. And I could go on and on. So I want you to get the connection that's made here in verse 18. The humiliating message of the cross is chained with titanium links to the power of God. And that means we need to be very careful. We need to be very careful as we try to make the gospel, the word of the cross, more palatable to our culture. We try to dress up the gospel to hide the shame. And Paul is telling us here that when we do that, we empty it of the power of God. Get that link. It's not my link. It's not Paul's link. That's God's link. God, in his wisdom, Paul says later in this passage, chose this message. God chose this way of salvation. God chose this shameful cross. And if we try to hide it, we try to camouflage it, we try to cover it up, we try to take away, drain away the shame, we drain away the power. And I'll come back to this at the end of the message. In verses 19 through 21, Paul tries in a second way to dislodge Greek philosophy and rhetoric from the place that it still had in the thinking of some of the Corinthian Christians by reminding us that God is determined to destroy the wisdom of the world. God will destroy the wisdom of the world. Now, to this point in my message, I've restricted myself to speaking to the historical situation in which Paul found himself. But we need to understand that worldly wisdom still has a place in the lives of many believers today. This isn't just a historical thing. It's not just something out there. It's not just something back there. Now, I realize that very few of us, and certainly very few Americans, follow philosophers today. In fact, the average American is allergic to the word philosophy. He breaks out in hives. But all the same, many people today have a great regard for human wisdom. Human wisdom, human intelligence holds sway in every major area of life, in education, in science, in technology, in government, in finance. It goes on and on. You turn on your television. You turn on the internet. What do you get? You get some talking head telling you how wise they are. And why you need to follow them. Now, we don't call them philosophers, but they fill the same role in our culture. Whether you call them experts or scientists or PhDs or researchers or some other high-flung title. Think of the confidence that vast swaths of our society have placed in these kinds of thought leaders during the COVID pandemic. Very few people in the industrialized nations of the world had any doubt that with our human intelligence, we could conquer COVID. We just needed a little bit of time to deploy our human brain power. Isn't that how you remember it? It's how I remember it. Now, I hope at this point that maybe some of these folks would have a little bit more humility, but you know, it doesn't seem that way. We are ever so confident that our scientists and our politicians and our researchers can conquer any obstacle that faces us. Listen, American Christians are just as likely to be influenced by worldly wisdom as the Corinthians were. It's our default setting in our culture. And in verses 19 and 20, Paul takes his best shot to puncture this faith in human wisdom, in human reason. And he does so by directly quoting from Scripture. So Paul basically proof texts here. He basically goes back to Isaiah chapter 29, and he says, I want to show you that God is going to destroy the wisdom of the wise. Now, Paul doesn't quote even the entire verse. He quotes just part of Isaiah 29:14. I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Paul assures us that God will destroy the wisdom of the wise. Now, I don't want to take time to dive deep into Isaiah 29 and 30, but I think we at least need to understand the context of the verse that Paul is quoting here. In the time of Isaiah, Jerusalem was under threat of a brand new world superpower, Assyria. And the leaders in Jerusalem were worried about how they were going to stand up to the new 900-pound gorilla on the world scene. And the law of Moses made clear that the rulers of God's people were never to look back to Egypt for deliverance. But that's exactly what the counselors of the king were advising. The wisdom of the wise and the understanding of the prudent counseled that a treaty with Egypt could stave off an attack by Assyria. And God reacted against that counsel of the wise. He said that he would turn the wisdom of the wise and the understanding of the prudent on its head. And the wise were completely wrong. In fact, God said that he would ensure that the treaty with Egypt would bring Israel to the attention of Assyria sooner rather than later. Now, how many of you know the general outline of Old Testament history? Isaiah wrote in 760, 750 BC. Any of you know what happened in 732 BC? The nation of Israel was carried off into captivity by the Assyrians. Now, by quoting this verse, Paul indicates that God's New Testament people face a similar decision, a similar dilemma. The Corinthian Christians and us, we need to decide, will we follow the wisdom of God and the power of God, or will we follow the wisdom of the world? And Paul, by quoting this verse from Isaiah, reminds us that when we make that decision, we need to take into account God's control of the future. It's very important to understand that verse 19 speaks in the future tense. Do you see that? Look at verse 19. I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and I will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. See, it's obvious right now, in this present age, that human wisdom holds sway. I mean, the average human being sees no reason not to put their faith and trust in education and science and technology and government, in the wisdom of the wise and the understanding of the prudent. Even many Christians. I think especially in our American culture, have difficult time not thinking that, hey, that we can trust those things. We can trust those people. It's very easy for us to look back to Egypt. But to have the right estimate of the wisdom of this world, we need to look to the future from God's perspective. To what God has promised in the end times, in that final day, we who follow Jesus Christ will see our ultimate salvation. We will be delivered from the lake of fire. And what will happen to the worldly wise? They will be destroyed. They will be cast into the lake of fire. Every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. In that day, God will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The wisdom of the wise which despises the cross, which rejects the gospel, will finally and ultimately be destroyed. And then its true worth will be obvious to everybody. And this truth that's based on what God has determined to do in the future enables Paul to make a final assessment of the worldly wise, of the scribe, of the debater at the end of verse 20. Notice that God has made the wisdom of the world foolish. God has made the wisdom of the world foolish. Now, that is not the statement that I would expect. I would expect that this statement would be in the future tense. That God will make the wisdom of the world foolish. When God destroys the wisdom of the wise in the end times at that final day, that wisdom will indeed look foolish, won't it? But that's not what Paul says. Because God has determined now to destroy worldly wisdom in that final day. It is absolutely certain. For those of us who follow Jesus, this promise of God is a done deal. It's as good as accomplished fact. And so what Paul is teaching us here is that we ought to evaluate the intelligent, the wise, the educated right now, from the perspective of eternity. Why should we care what they think? Why should their opinions and their criticisms scare us or influence us? Ultimately, they are the fools. Because they do not see the world and they do not see history through God's eyes. So often today we hear the phrase, on the right side of history. I'll tell you who's on the right side of history. Those who have trusted Jesus Christ, who have heard the word of the cross, and trusted the Savior. We alone are on the right side of history. Well, verse 21 is kind of a recap of everything that Paul has said to this point, and so for the sake of time, I'm not going to unpack it, since most of that is a repetition of what Paul has already said. I want to quickly move on to the third way that Paul seeks to make clear that we must not somehow combine worldly wisdom with the gospel and empty it of its power and its... And Paul does that in verses 22 through 24 by explaining how countercultural the gospel must be. How countercultural the gospel must be. Remember, many in the Corinthian church had not purged the influences of the Greco-Roman culture from their lives, from their thinking. Paul answered them by making clear that the gospel is the ultimate countercultural truth. The gospel must run counter to the culture that is dominated by human wisdom. You know, I'm always amused when I hear that this person or that movement is described as countercultural. I grew up in the 60s and the 70s when the word countercultural was coined to describe what was happening back then. Well, let me tell you, what was countercultural in the 60s and 70s became the culture in the 90s. Think about where the countercultural was 10 or 15 years ago. That's what dominates Washington, D.C. today. The countercultural stays countercultural for about 5 minutes, with one exception. The gospel, in the length and breadth of history, remains countercultural. It is the one truth that always will be countercultural. Christ crucified turned the world on its head for the first time in the first century, and it's been doing the same thing ever since. And that's what Paul explains here in verses 22 and 23. Now, why did the culture in Corinth reject the gospel? Paul explains here in terms of both the Jewish culture and the Greek culture. Paul first of all addresses the Jewish culture in verse 22. He says that Jews request a sign. The word that's translated request there in our New King James Version, I believe, ought to be translated a bit more strongly in some of the other versions, the ESV, the New American Standard. They translate require. The Jews require a sign, or the Jews demand a sign. And I think if you look back at the history of the Jewish people, if you look back at the history of Israel, you understand why. I mean, the Old Testament is dominated by mighty acts of God. You have the 10 plagues, God bringing Israel out of Egypt at the Exodus. You have God parting the Red Sea. Later on, you have God parting the Jordan River at flood stage. You have the people at Mount Sinai seeing the fire, the smoke at the top of the mountain. The miracles of Elijah, the miracles of Elisha. You read the Psalms, often the psalmist will say, think back to the mighty acts of God, to the mighty works of God. So I think it's a little bit natural that the Jews look to these kinds of miraculous signs, but this history had an unexpected consequence in the hearts of many Jews in the New Testament era. And that is that instead of trusting God to do what God willed to do, many of these Jews demanded miraculous signs on their terms. This is what happened when the Jewish religious leaders encountered Jesus. They demanded of him what? Show us a sign to prove that you're the Messiah. And what did Jesus say to them? Only one sign you'll be given. The sign of Jonah. And Jesus delivered on that sign, his death and his resurrection. But they couldn't see it. They couldn't understand. It wasn't on their terms. And here in Paul's day, it continued. They were still looking for a Messiah that would do these miraculous signs on their terms. And when you combine that demand for miraculous signs with the fact that Jesus was crucified on the cursed tree, you add those two together and you come up with what Paul calls a stumbling block in verse 23. To the Jews, a stumbling block. I don't really like that translation, stumbling block. How many of you, when you come up to a concrete block, you trip over it? We don't do that. I mean, it's obvious. The idea is more of a stumbling stone. And that stone has two aspects to it. That stone is either something that you can stand on, you can find a footing, you can find a firm foundation, or you can trip over it. Those of us who have put our faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, we have found a foundation for our lives. We have found a place to stand. But these Jews, they stumbled over Jesus. They stumbled ultimately and finally and eternally. Paul next addresses Greek culture. I've already said a great deal about how the Greeks sought wisdom. I've described to you why they saw the cross as foolishness. You have to be a moron to believe the message of the cross. But the Son of God was crucified to save us. Now, I need to pause here almost done, but I need to circle back to where we began. Do you remember where we started this morning, where we started this message? There is a way that we can proclaim the gospel that empties it of its power, its results, its meaning. And what is that way? It's the wisdom of words. Our speech is influenced by the very wisdom that we've been describing here. If our words, if our speech is influenced by that wisdom, I want to talk about us for a few minutes before we close. I believe there are many evangelicals today who do not want to bear the shame of the cross. They do not want to be thought fools and morons by the intelligentsia out there. If the worldly wise are certain that human beings arrived here 6 billion years ago by means of evolution, then there are evangelicals out there that are willing to surrender on a six-day creation by the direct hand of God. Yeah, God created us, but He created us through billions of years of evolution. If the worldly wise decree that homosexuals should have the right to marry one another, then there are some evangelicals who do not want to bear the shame in the public square of maintaining that homosexuality is a sin. And there are some evangelicals who are surrendering on this issue. They don't want to bear that reproach. They don't want to be thought fools and morons by the worldly wise. They're willing to say that two individuals who truly love each other, even if they're of the same sex, if they're in a monogamous marital relationship, well, then God can bless that, and that's not sinful. Now, I can multiply examples like that on and on, but that's not really my point. Here's the point that I want to make. When evangelicals have that kind of an attitude, when they are willing to trim where they stand on what Scripture teaches to accommodate the wisdom of the world, will they not also be willing to do exactly that same thing when it comes to proclaiming the gospel? Do you think that that's happening in evangelical churches today? I do. I mean, what does it look like in our day when evangelicals seek to make the gospel palatable to our culture so that people will not think that they are fools and morons? I wish I was having a discussion this afternoon because I would love to discuss this question. Now, I think there are some people in our culture that are like the Jews. They have to see it to believe it. They're very practical. They're very pragmatic. You try to talk to them about heaven or hell, I don't want to hear that. I can't see heaven. I don't know anything about hell. Certainly don't want to talk to you about Jesus dying on the cross because it's just not practical for me. There are people in our culture like that. There are certainly a lot of people in our culture who are like the Greeks. If you can find it in a scientific journal somewhere, if a scientist says this, if this is what the educators are saying, that's what they believe. But you know what? There's a lot of popular culture out there that doesn't do either of those things, does it? Think of what you find out there on Facebook, on the influencers on Facebook. Where are those people coming from? How do they persuade people? Where do people follow them? I'm not going to answer that question, but here's the thing. I believe that that's what's influencing many evangelicals in how they present the gospel. And here's the thing. This passage teaches when we do that, we empty the gospel of its power. Now, I can understand. I can understand where many of these evangelical preachers are coming from, because they want to see people saved. And they think it's all on them. They think they are the ones that have to persuade them. And so they're willing to do whatever they have to do to dress up the gospel, to make it palatable to people. But see, they've got it wrong. There's one last truth that you need to get from verse 24 that rounds out everything that I'm saying. Who accepts the gospel? Who responds to Christ crucified? What does Paul say in verse 24? The called. Who calls? Who calls? God calls. See, this isn't about me dressing up the gospel and making it palatable enough to the worldly wise so that somehow I can draw them into my church. This is a matter of God calling and doing the work that only He can do. My concern is not with persuading men using worldly wisdom. My concern is calling down the power of God and making sure that I present the gospel in a simple and straightforward way that will not drain it of the power of God. So, my conclusion is very simple. How many of you are willing to say with the Apostle Paul this morning, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation. I will not be so afraid to present the gospel in its shameful simplicity that I feel like I have to dress it up and camouflage it. Will you refuse to be cowed by the worldly wise? Will you commit yourself to Christ crucified, to the simple message of the cross? It is the power of God unto salvation.